And then I'm going to talk about the general sort of scheme that I'm talking about, which will be a preparation, transformation, measurement type scheme, an operational scheme. Then I'm going to talk about states within this scheme and give various definitions. Then I'll present five axioms, which give rise to quantum theory for finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. And then I'm going to talk briefly about some work that goes beyond these axioms, hopefully in the direction of quantum gravity, or certainly in the direction of new, possibly in the direction of new physics. Okay, so if you look at quantum theory as it stands, it consists of some fairly abstract mathematics. You have density matrices, which are operators on Hilbert space, positive operators corresponding to measurements, unitary evolution, or more generally, super operators. Maybe I should use this. Okay, unitary evolution, or more generally, super operators. You have, of course, Hilbert spaces, complex Hilbert spaces, and you have tensor products. And it's this very abstract structure, and it's not clear where it comes from. So the question is, and of course this is a question that has been asked at this conference many times, can we account for the structure of quantum theory by some reasonable axioms or principles? It's worth taking a little while to think about some historical examples of where people tried attempted a similar endeavor. I don't pretend I'm going to be as successful as the people on this transparency. But I think it's worthwhile investigating the spirit of previous work. So for example, we had Kepler came up with his rather abstract laws for planetary motion. And he was able to get some fairly good empirically adequate laws, but they're kind of crazy. Where did these laws come from? Newton was able to show that they followed from his laws for mechanics plus his law of universal gravitation. And so he was able to explain Kepler's laws in terms of some sort of reasonable axioms or principles. A similar thing happened with Lorentz and Einstein. So the Lorentz transformations were found to be the correct transformations for electromagnetism, from Maxwell's equations. Then Einstein showed how you could derive those transformations from some reasonable principles. What's interesting is that not only did you get the kind of feel-good factor, the sort of cozy feeling of having understood the physics the previous times, but by finding deeper principles, you were able to go beyond quantum theory. Sorry, or beyond, that's coming later, beyond Newtonian mechanics and beyond special relativity to new theories, such as general relativity. Another thing happened, which is even at this stage, Newton, for example, was able to predict the orbit of comets, or even the orbit of objects coming from completely outside the galaxy, which couldn't have been predicted by Kepler. Outside the solar system. Einstein got his E equals mc squared equation, which wasn't immediately apparent at the level of the Lorentz transformations. So it seems it's worthwhile to try and do this type of thing, to try and find the deep principles underlying the theories of the day, both because it helps you understand those theories, but also because it will help you go beyond. But there's a word of warning. Okay, so maybe not many of you read this book very seriously, at least. So careful. The problem with axioms is you have to be careful, you know, not to sort of end up convincing yourself that the most abstract things are very reasonable. So you should be aware of Leslie Lamport's axiom 3.1. I hope that's clear. Is it clear? It will. It may become clear if you hold on a second. Is it become clear?
Read it.
Okay. So it's a shame if you can't see it. Well, never mind. What it says is axiom 3.1. All axioms are very dull. And you can see next to it, he tells you how to LaTeX this particular axiom. And I think that's a real concern. I mean, you write down axioms, you might convince yourself they're fantastic, but everyone else thinks they're pretty boring. So it's worth bearing that in mind. When you look at quantum theory, in the end, it's just a probability calculus. It's a sort of meta theory that you can apply to many different situations. In that sense, it's very similar to what you might call classical probability theory. So classical probability theory can be applied to Newtonian mechanics, to statistical mechanics, to electromagnetism, to gambling, to any number of classical physical situations. Likewise, quantum theory, it might be called quantum probability theory, can be applied to, for example, a particle in a one-dimensional well, quantum electrodynamics, quantum computing, some sets of interacting spin particles, and so on and so forth. Quantum theory up here is a sort of probability theory. It's a meta theory, which applies to any number of different physical situations down here. And it's very analogous to this situation. And so it's conceivable that if we go beyond beyond quantum theory, beyond classical theory, we might go to some more general or some different structure over here. And likewise, that might correspond to some new physics down here. So I'm going to, at some point, write down some axioms. Obviously, axioms have to apply to some particular context. Certainly, axioms in physics have to apply to some particular physical context. And the context we have here is one of preparation, transformation, measurement. So you can see we have three types of apparatus, a preparation apparatus, a transformation apparatus, and a measurement apparatus. The idea is that the preparation apparatus prepares systems in some particular state. The transformation apparatus acts on it and changes it to maybe some new state. And then the measurement apparatus performs some measurement, and you have outcomes of that measurement. There's a few extra features on this diagram. So each of these devices has a knob. So the preparation device has a knob that you can vary to change the preparation that you're affecting. Transformation has one to change the to vary the transformation that you're affecting, and the measurement has one to vary the measurement that you're affecting. The preparation apparatus has a release button. The idea of that is that if you don't press the release button, then sort of nothing goes through the apparatus, and so you always get a special outcome, which is the null outcome. That's this one here. It's actually not an essential feature of this argument. I put it in because it makes things a bit clearer. And now, given this this setup, I'm going to introduce one axiom. So the axiom is this: that the quantity p, which is taken to be the limit of the number of times you get a certain outcome divided by the total number of times, as this tends to infinity, takes the same value whenever a given measurement follows a given preparation on an ensemble. So if you measure this on Monday, you get the same value as if you measure it again on Tuesday. It's not a very good axiom in the sense that there are all sorts of problems with using frequencies, relative frequencies, to define probabilities. But really, this talk isn't concerned with the interpretation of probability theory or the interpretation of probability as a concept. I'm more concerned with the structures that arise within a theory of probability. So I'm just going to stick with this because it's nice and simple. Okay, so now I'll give a definition of what I mean by a state. The notion of state, I mean, is discussed all the time in physics, but people rarely stop to think about what it actually means. I think there are two types of notion that people have in physics, or maybe more, but there's two that I want to mention. One is a sort of a notion, an ontological notion, a notion that the state actually describes the way reality is. Okay, so you might say, well, I went into the room and this was happening and that was happening, and you're trying to describe what's actually happening in the room. You're trying to describe the actual state of affairs. Another notion of state, and that's the one I'll use here, is a more operational notion. So rather than describing the state of affairs, you just want to describe what happens if you do something. What happens if you make a measurement? And so specifically, this is the definition that I'll give. The state associated with a preparation is that thing represented by any mathematical object which can be used to calculate the probability for any outcome for any measurement. Okay, so if you look at the state in quantum theory, it can be understood in these terms. You have the density matrix representing the state of a system, and you can use the density matrix to calculate the probability for any outcome of any measurement that you might perform. Okay, so given this definition of the state, one mathematical object which suffices is simply a list of all probabilities for all outcomes for all measurements. So this is a very, very long list of alpha runs of every outcome for every measurement that you might conceivably perform on this preparation. So given that long list of probabilities, if you want to calculate the probability for a particular outcome, all you have to do is take r dot p, where r is a long vector with a 1 in the appropriate position corresponding to the alpha that you're interested in, and then zeros everywhere else. Okay. So the probability is simply given by r dot p. But this is kind of crazy. Because if you look at what you've got here, you've just got this list which contains the outcome, the probability for every outcome of every measurement. It's a very, very long list. I mean, it would in principle be not just infinite, but actually continuously infinite, even when you had finite dimensional situations. So that's not so good. So we expect any actual physical theory to have some structure implicit in it. And so we shouldn't need that very long list that I had on the previous slide. And so what we imagine is that instead we should be able to write the state just by listing a smaller set of probabilities corresponding to some particular fiducial probabilities. Some particular set of fiducial measurement outcomes. Okay, so we imagine that we have k. Fiducial measurements, or measurement outcomes, I should really say, and they correspond to different settings of the measurement apparatus, and you select a particular outcome for each of those. Okay. So this is a shorter list, and we make this list in such a way that it's just sufficient to calculate a general probability by a linear formula. Okay. So actually, this is a slightly different definition than the one I give in my papers, and the one you might have heard me talk about before. Previously, I just defined it to be the minimum number of probabilities required in any such list, and then proved this formula had to be linear. But rather than doing that, it makes life more complicated. You can just define it like this. Okay? And given that this formula is linear, we know that it's clearly possible to have a linear formula. And then it's just a matter of choosing the linear formula where this has the minimum number of elements. And then you can use the reasoning in my previous proof that that this formula was linear. You can change that round and just show that k by this definition is the same as k by the other definition. Okay. So this is a central formula that we have. Probability is equal to R dot P. P is, of course, now representing the state, and R is associated with the measurement. So for each measurement that you might perform, you have a different, or possibly different R. So I want to give a few definitions before stating the axioms. So actually, one definition I should draw your attention to, because it's really important, is K. K is just this number of probabilities that's required in this just sufficient minimal list, okay, so that you can have this linear formula. So that's really important. The next thing I want to define is what I'm going to call the information carrying capacity. Okay, and that's just going to be equal to log of the number of distinct messages you can encode with states. So consider this situation. You have some states coming in, some possible states coming into a measurement apparatus, and you have the measurement apparatus set in such a way that you can try and distinguish them. So to be clearer, imagine you have some set of states, P1, P2, up to PN. Okay. And imagine you can find a measurement apparatus which is such that you can distinguish these states in a single shot measurement. What that means is this measurement apparatus must have the property that each of those states gives rise to disjoint sets of outcomes. Okay, so P1 might give rise to the first three outcomes. We're ignoring the null outcome here. P2 might give rise to the next two, and so on. Okay. And so we have sets like this, and N is defined to be the maximum number of reliably distinguishable states. And then this thing I'm calling the information carrying capacity is just log to base 2 of n. Okay. And then I want another definition. We say that a system is constrained to have information carrying capacity log to the base 2 of m if the allowed states are constrained in such a way that for a measurement set to distinguish all n states, we only get outcomes associated with some subset m of these states. Okay, so this definition relies on having a particular measurement operator set to distinguish some set of n distinguishable states, where n is a maximal set. This is a maximal set, and then we say we have constrained the system if the states can only belong to some subset. So for example, it might be that the outcomes actually can only correspond to those in the first three cases here. Yeah. Because you can see then that by this measurement, you can now only send M signals using these states rather than the full N. Once you've shown that the formula for calculating probabilities is linear, it's very straightforward to show that the effect of a transformation is also linear. So it's given by acting on the state P by a matrix Z, which is K times K dimensional. Okay. And it's real. Everything here is real. So now the situation is, for a system, for a particular type of system, we have states belonging to some set of allowed states. We have measurements belonging to some set of allowed measurements. We have transformations belonging to some set of allowed transformations. We have K, which is the number of fiducial measurements required to specify the state, and N, which is related to the information carrying capacity. So it's worth looking at classical and quantum theory in these contexts. So classical probability theory, you can imagine a situation where you have a classical system which can be in one of n states. Well, then you can represent the state. So you can imagine a classical system which can be in one of n distinct states. For example, a ball, which can be in one of n boxes. And then you can represent the actual state just as a list of probabilities for the ball being in each of those boxes. Okay, so you can see here that k, which is the number of probabilities in this list, is just equal to n. Here's a particular example. If n is equal to 2, then we just have two distinct possibilities where the ball is in box 1, possibilities where the ball is in box 2, and then we have mixtures of those. But these represent pure states. Okay. In quantum theory, the situation is different. The state in the standard quantum formulation is represented by a density matrix, which is a list of probabilities down the diagonal, plus some numbers above the diagonal and below the diagonal, which are themselves linearly related to some probabilities that you can measure. So you can, instead of representing the state by rho, you can actually represent it by a list of probabilities which is of length equal to the number of real parameters in this matrix. And that turns out that's n squared. So rather than representing the state by this, you can represent it by a list of probabilities of length equals n squared. So an example is a qubit, n equals 2. And you can show that in the case of a qubit, the probabilities for getting outcomes along these three, imagine it's a spin half particle, so for getting outcomes spin up along these three directions, are constrained to live inside a sphere which fits inside the unit cube. And the pure states are now the states on the surface of this ball. Okay. Okay, I want to come back to these two comments in a moment. Let me give a few more definitions. So two systems are said to have the same properties if you can find some mapping. So imagine a situation where you have preparation, transformation, measurement on one system. For example, it might be the spin degree of freedom of an electron. And some measurements, preparation, transformation, and measurement on a different system, which might, for example, be the polarization degree of freedom of a photon. Okay, if you have this, you can find a mapping between preparations in these two cases, transformations and measurements, such that at the end you get the same probability for outcomes which are identified under this mapping. Okay. And the reason, of course, in quantum theory you can do that is because both these cases are represented by a Hilbert space of dimension 2. Okay. So this is the general definition. Systems have the same properties if you have these mappings. Few more definitions. Pure states are states which cannot be simulated by mixtures of distinct states. A reversible transformation. This is a transformation for which there exists another transformation in the set of allowed transformations, which has the property that if you do the initial transformation, follow it by this transformation, then you get the same state out as you put in for all possible states. A continuous transformation is a transformation which can be simulated by lots of transformations which are small, in the sense that each of these transformations has an infinitesimal effect on probabilities. So any probability for some measurement outcome here will only be infinitesimally different afterwards. So just let me come back to this slide. I keep wanting to call it a transparency, but it's not transparent. I mean, it's a piece of paper. It seems I have to resort to the old language, which slides are the things, I guess, that went in projectors in the old days. Okay, so in this case, the pure states form a discrete set, and you have reversible transformations. These are just the permutation transformations, but they also form a discrete set. You don't have a continuous set of transformations. And likewise, the pure states, the pure states in the case of quantum theory form a continuous set. They're all the sets, they're all the states on the surface of this ball. And reversible transformations now form a continuous set. These are the unitary transformations. Okay, so here are the five axioms. So the first axiom is the same as is just the one I gave you before. It's about the stability of probabilities. The second axiom, which I'm now stating in a slightly different way than I have in the published papers, concerns information. It says that, that systems having or constrained to have the same information carrying capacity have the same properties. So in the case of quantum theory, for example, you can imagine having a system which is described by a three-dimensional Hilbert space, but where you constrain the state so that it only ever has support on some given two-dimensional Hilbert space. But in that case, the properties of that system would be the same as the properties of a system just having a two-dimensional Hilbert space, like a qubit. Axiom three concerns composite systems. And it just says, if you have a composite system made out of systems A and B, then total n, the total number of reliably distinguishable states, is for the composite system is just given by the product, which means, incidentally, that you add the information carrying capacities because you take the log of this formula. And k, the number of fiducial measurements required to specify the state, is also given by a product. Axiom four is the essential axiom to get quantum theory. It says that there exists a continuous reversible transformation between any two pure states. And we know this is true in quantum theory. And we know it's also not true in classical probability theory. Axiom five is simplicity. And this is the axiom I dislike the most. But it seems it's probably necessary. Axiom five says that for each n, k takes the minimum value. And I'll explain how that works in a moment. So I'm not going to actually give you the full reconstruction, obviously, but just an outline of the reconstruction. So we use axiom two. That implies that k is a function of n. After all, k is something that is determined by the properties as I define them, and so k has to be a function of n, because all systems having the same information carrying capacity have the same properties. You can also show, although it isn't quite as obvious, that k of n plus 1 is strictly greater than k of n. Okay. It's not too difficult to prove this. And then axiom 3 can be written like this, or it can be used to prove this. And then this is actually what's called in number theory a completely multiplicative function. And you can use these equations here to prove that k is equal to n to the power r. It's interesting, Bill Wouters speculated that this was a general relationship corresponding to something that he wrote down, which was like this property. But if you actually include these properties at the top, then you can prove that it has to be like this using some elementary number theory. And r is an integer. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. Then you try the r equals 1 case. See, now because we have the simplicity axiom, we have to take the smallest value of r that works. So we try the r equals 1 case, and it doesn't work because we can't get continuous transformations. So then we take the r equals 2 case, and that does work. Okay, and then we can continue with the reconstruction. We now apply axiom 4, the continuity axiom, to the special case where n equals 2 and k equals 4, and we can reconstruct the block sphere. Incidentally, one of these four numbers, one of these four fiducial measurements is associated with overall normalization. And so it doesn't appear in the box view. Then we use axiom two in successive two-dimensional subspaces. And we're able to get the general rho and A for general N and also get the trace formula. And then there are more details. We use axiom three to construct tensor product structure. And this is the composite system axiom. And we use some general considerations to get the right class of transformations. And this also gives us the general measurement theory. Okay. So there's a lot of details. The reconstruction theorem isn't actually very difficult. It's just a bit involved. Okay. So in the last 2-3 years, I've been trying to see how to go beyond this framework. And I now have some results on that, which I'm not going to present at this conference. I'll present at the next conference. So if you're in Constance in a few weeks' time, you'll hear about it. But let me just briefly explain what I've been trying to do. So the most pressing issue in foundational physics at the moment is trying to reconcile quantum theory with general relativity, which is both an interesting question in itself, but it's also interesting as a way of trying to see how generalized probability structures can be useful in going beyond present physics. And if you look at these two theories, well, quantum theory is probabilistic. I mean, it's intrinsically probabilistic, but it has fixed causal structure. What I mean by that is the places where you make measurements and do transformations and so on have a fixed causal relationship to one another, which is set out in advance. For example, in a quantum network, if you have some sequence of gates, which might be applied. This is a bad drawing. You can say, well, these are done at the same time, and are sort of, in some sense, space-like separated from one another. And that's fixed. It's independent of any results you might get. And these two, for example, are done at sequential times. And that's also fixed. It's independent of any actual measurement outcomes. That relationship is fixed in advance. And quantum theory has this structure. In particular, quantum theory has a time coordinate, which imposes a time ordering on events, on measurements, and consequently, it has to have this fixed causal structure built into it. If you look at general relativity, well, it's deterministic. And of course, you can try and do some statistics for GR, so this determinism isn't necessarily, doesn't have to be in any formulation of general relativity, but it is a deterministic theory at root. But it has dynamic causal structure. The actual relationship, the causal relationship between events depends on the outcomes of measurements, depends on the specific state of distribution of matter, and so on. So if you're going to try and unify these two things, but what you would want is a probability theory which has dynamic causal structure. So the thing I've given you up to now isn't sufficient. I gave you a probability theory which had fixed causal structure. We want to find a framework for probability theories which have dynamic causal structure. And I found a framework which seems to do this. It's a discrete framework, so there's certainly going to be problems with getting to a situation where you have continuous variables like you do in general relativity, although that might not be a problem in quantum gravity. But in any case, I have a framework which I'm not going to go into great detail, but I'll just try and give you the rough idea. Okay, it's always embarrassing when you have to invent a new word for something. What I wanted was a word to describe this object, which describes the causal structure, which is implicit in a physical theory. Okay, so it has to be a word describing an object, and this object contains information about causal structure. So I'm going to call it the causaloid. What's interesting about this formalism is if you specify the causaloid for a particular theory, then then, so all the theory-specific details actually go into the specification of this thing called the causal load. And then the equations that are left over, which tell you how to make predictions, are the same for different theories. So you get all the theory-specific structure into this object called the causal load. And what's left over, the equations that you use to make predictions, are the same. So that's likely to be useful if you're trying to merge two different theoretical structures, two different theories, like general relativity and quantum theory. So this is what the causal load does. So we start off with a sort of operationally defined notion of space-time. And I don't have time to set up how I go about defining that. But roughly speaking, different regions in this operationally defined space-time, operationally defined region of space-time, different regions correspond to different places you might extract data, and different places you might make choices as to what measurements to perform. Okay. And now the causal load gives a quantitative measure of how the number of fiducial measurements is reduced when we go to a composite system, to a composite region. So we can consider measurements in each of these two regions, R1 and R2, and then we can consider measurements that correspond to the joint system, R1 union R2. Actually, I should call it the joint region. It's not a system, it's a region. And the causal load gives a quantitative measure of how that number of measurements, how the number of fiducial measurements is reduced. So here are two sort of extreme examples. So one example might be where the two regions are space-like. And in that case, we would expect the number of fiducial measurements simply to multiply between the two regions, okay, and the corresponding structure to come from multiplication. So in that case, there isn't actually any reduction. Another case would be where the two regions are sequential. So imagine, for example, you have a system, an electron, and you make measurements. You make a measurement of spin at time t1, and then you make another measurement of spin at time t2, which is immediately sequential in your setup. Well, in that case, if you are able to establish the state by tomography at time t1, okay, you don't need any further measurements to establish the state at time t2. So the joint region consisting of things you might do at time t1 plus things you might do at time t2, that joint region, which has k1, k2, sorry, k1, 2, is actually established by measurements at the earlier time. Okay, so k for the total system is just equal to, for the total region, is just equal to k1 or equal to k2. So you can see here that by quantifying the way in which the number of measurements is reduced, you get a handle on the causal structure which is inherent in the data. Okay, if the two regions are connected in a strong causal way so that they're immediately sequential, the number of measurements required is less than if they are space-like separated. Okay, so by putting all this information into this object causal load, you can get a handle on that. And then you can use this object, the causal load, to calculate probabilities for anything that might go on in this weak region. Okay, so that's a rather rough treatment of what goes on there. So let me give the conclusions. So we can show that probability theories can be regarded as a setting for general physical theories, not just for quantum theory, but for other theories, general relativity, maybe quantum gravity, and so on and so forth. Quantum theory itself can be seen as arising from five axioms in this general setting of probability theories. The big question of why we should do this, well, one reason, of course, is to get this cozy feeling we have when we feel that we've understood something. But a more important reason is that this might give us a way to go beyond the physics of the day into some physics in the future. And that's it. Thank you. So I mean, this is a sort of general. What I'm trying to do here is get this general framework, which is this slide, in terms of these objects. So it's a general framework which might apply to many different physical theories. I think it's only when you go to a specific physical theory that you start to specify a particular Hamiltonian, and then H-bar comes in. So at this general meta level, you don't fix any H-bar. I mean, so long as you're restricted to this framework, it doesn't. I mean, one thing to note is actually in quantum information, people rarely write down H-bar. Because the framework doesn't, you don't need that. You just include it in all your gates already. I think obviously at some point you would want something like H-bar to come in to the framework if you start to specialize down to a particular theory. You know, so if you go from this box down into this box, then you would want H-bar to come in. But so long as you're at this level, H-bar doesn't seem to make an appearance. Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I certainly don't have a theory of quantum gravity yet, so I can't tell you how that works. I can't hear you very well. So I tried for a number of years to get something like that to work. More recently, Karol Tchaikovsky and I have been trying to construct a theory which has k equals n to the power of 4. Okay, and we seem to have a model which appears to work, although we're not 100% confident. I think what would be interesting there is if, and this is what we're trying to do, is you construct a model which not only has k equals n to the power of 4, but also you could show that quantum theory is a special case of that, just in the same way as classical probability theory is a special case of quantum theory. So it could just be that we have to go through another revolution like we did previously when we went from classical to quantum, where we go from quantum to this other thing. So that would be exciting. But, So beautifully, the complex numbers come from the fact that you have n equal to na, nb, and k equal to ka, kb from the axiom, because you can show that that isn't true for real numbers or for quaternions or any other thing. If you look at the number of parameters in the density matrix, okay, the number of parameters is equal to n squared, only by virtue of the fact that those numbers are complex. So it comes from this composite system axiom.
For your causal line, can you give an example that's intermediate between the two examples that you gave? There's the baseline.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could certainly set one up even just within, say, quantum theory, where you have, let's imagine we have three systems. Let's see how am I doing this. But actually, I'm going to regard this as one region, and this is another region. Okay. So then, So then the measurements that correspond to here and here are going to multiply, but the ones that correspond to here and here don't. So the overall thing is intermediate. Yes, in a sense, what's strange here is interference kind of takes a back seat as far as being a fundamental perspective on quantum theory is concerned. I mean, it's still clearly there because you get standard quantum theory out of these axioms. I think part of the reason for that is that you now think of states as being lists of probabilities. And so whereas interference is more to do with states being represented by vectors in a Hilbert space, in this way of thinking, really, the pure states, the states in the Hilbert space, just parameterize the states on the surface of the convex shape. So in some sense, pure states are not as central as they are in a more standard point of view, and consequently, interference is not conceptually as central as you might think. But even so, the fact that you have this continuity axiom is telling you can go from one pure state to another via intermediate pure states is you know, would be related at some level to interference. Thank you.
So our next talk will be by Tim Cook. The next talk is going to be by Tim Cook.
Quantum logic, space, and the next to the word Fallot-Randolph, and this is a personal suggestion that you might want to offer for next year's. Sorry.